What did you think of the ability of Sir Baron Jadilka?
I had much to do with him.
What about later on? Who was your minister in 1948?
I started with Sir Dunkelman.
Oh, what sort of man was he?
Well, he was unusual in many ways. He was he'd been a civil servant.
Oh, I see.
Mathematician, eccentric, and of course he knew the ropes from our point of view.
Mm.
And he left everything to me. He didn't interfere in any way.
Except
interview with Mr. R. N. Bond, continued, same date, 26-11-65.
I was asking about Sir Tampanam. Weren't you under Sir John after some time?
As Prime Minister.
Oh, no, not directly under him.
Who
succeeded Sir Tampanam?
Sir Tampanam, well, I had minister for a month, and that was an example of the maintenance of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
It was a man called Nalaya.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was a teacher, basically. But he came. Yes, I think there was an election and the Templar wasn't put back as minister. Mm. And I was put back and there was I received a message from the Director General of Broadcasting with one of my departments to say that Malaya was in the house of the Tamil program organizer, Tamil girl.
Mm.
And he'd been taking drink and wouldn't leave the place. So what should we do? And two of us went down and found him there and said,
why, the girl wanted him to leave and he wouldn't?
Yes, he was making advantage to this girl, you see, and he wouldn't leave the place. So we said,
you knew him personally?
Minister? Yeah. Well, he was my minister.
Oh, I see, after some time.
No, after a month. You better come away. He was living in a hotel. So we took him away in our car. And,
he was drunk, was he?
He'd been drinking, yes. He had a bottle. A very difficult situation. I didn't know how to cope with it.
Yes.
Because if the press got hold of it, it would be extremely awkward.
Yes, it would have been awkward.
So we recorded this girl's statement and we eventually decided to inform the Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
So I went along to Temple Trees. We took the girl up, you know, at
did she want to make a complaint?
9 o'clock at night.
Did she want to make a complaint to the police?
No, the police didn't come into the car. No, it was just this awkward situation.
Mm.
So we told the Dudleys in America.
Mm-hmm.
And we reported this matter and left the notes with him and spoke to the Queen. In the meantime, Mel and I had gone to some rest house. He was, of course, very distressed about this. So, well, it's in the Prime Minister's hands now. Well, it resulted in his being called upon to
resign.
Mm. Which he did, on the ground that we said, look, this is going to cause a scandal.
Mm.
And if you will resign, nothing will be said about it. If you resign, the ground is built up. You've got to go to India or something. We promised nothing more to be said about it. And he did. Nothing was said at all about it.
With the director,
now that was the maintenance of standards, you see.
Yes, I see. Who was the director of broadcasting?
Now it meant luncheon with the BBC. He came to help us to organise the service.
How had he got to hear of this?
I had a ring next morning from Vaidyanathan, from Kandar Vaidyanathan, who was the minister, the prime minister's permanent secretary, a grand, great man, Vaidyanathan.
Oh, was he an able man?
A very able, very able man. And he rang me up and got at me on having taken action. Now, he'd gone next morning to prime minister, you see, so they couldn't have been hidden. And nothing was said about it. But the point is this, that it created a very difficult situation.
Yes.
I said to the minister, look, how can you run this ministry now? You put yourself in an impossible position. You'll be found in the house of one of your own minor
employed
official program. She was the school's program organizer. Very difficult.
How did Mr. Lanson come to hear of it? She had called him and...
Yes, she was in a difficult position, you see. And
she was telling us.
Head of her department. So he once reported to me.
Yes, I see.
But the point was that he placed himself in our power, you see, through doing it. And it meant that
he couldn't be
once I reported it, either he went or I went, you see. But he went. Now that was a great tribute to the service and a great tribute to Ceylon, that the Prime Minister had maintained these standards, of rectitude in the minister, that he wouldn't permit this sort of conduct on the part of one of his ministers. He called upon him to resign. Now, that never went to studio.
It did.
But it was great to do. I said, Vaidyanathan rang me up, congratulated me. But we did our best to maintain the traditions of the service, tradition of the British cabinet, that if this happened, the minister resigned. And he did.
What did you think of DSN Naika as a prime minister?
Well, he had great natural intuition. I think that was his great secret.
Did he try to do too much?
I don't think so. Mm. In what way did he?
Or did he take on too many tasks himself?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. No.
And
I think educationally he was always disadvantaged. But
how did that affect him?
Vaidyanathan, who was his own permanent secretary. He used to say he had this wonderful intuition, you know, to do the right thing. He seemed to know by instinct what to do.
What about Dudley? You thought that he went into matters in too great a detail.
Well, he's a very conscientious man. I had the highest regard for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I shall deal with him over this matter for the minister.
Yes.
I had the highest regard for him. He was very conscientious, and he really...
Was he weak at that stage, on all crises?
No, I don't think so. No.
But you mentioned the fact that Oliver and J.I. were trying to bolster him up and prevent him
from... Yes, he wasn't fit, you know.
Oh, I see.
Yes, he got into a... He wasn't very fit. And they wanted him to go on, but he said he couldn't.
What about J.R. Jayawardena? What did you think of him?
He's a very capable man. He was Minister of Finance. I had to deal with him as a permanent secretary.
And Sir Oi?
Oi, well, of course, he's very capable.
I was wondering about Dudley. Did he like drive?
Yes, he hadn't as much drive as
Sir John.
But he was a very good man.
But didn't Sir John, for all his drive, rub some people up the wrong way?
Yes, he's rather tempestuous.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he's inclined to rush into a thing. But OEG was a very capable man.
Well, one got the impression about UNP rule in 1950. 1952 to 1955, they were becoming very complacent about their power and position, and they were not quite losing touch with the people and not having, well, couldn't quite get the pulse of the people as such.
Yes. Well, when the change came about, there was a very little change in the sense that things went on as they always had been. It was an aristocratic form of government, you know, much the same old families going on, and the same traditions. There was very little change, really.
But don't you think that there should have been some sort of branching out in new lines and doing something more for the underprivileged? In fact, if they had done that, they might not have lost power.
Yes, more could have been done.
And then there is this, all these remarks about the Uncle Neville party, you know, and the indications of nepotism in the party itself.
Well, of course, Sir John was one of the first ministers, you know. He was, in fact, I think, didn't he follow?
Oh, he was one of the earliest.
And he was capable, he had great capacity.
No, I was not thinking of Sir John in particular, but from the, in that period there seemed to be, and there's a lot of nepotism at the lower level, you know, among the ministers and the government jobs. And then lots of these ministers were going on what the people felt to be pleasure trips, of, you know, finding some excuse to go to some other country on business visits.
Yes. Well, I'm not very familiar with the details of it. It's difficult to avoid that sort of situation, isn't it? With a new government like that.
Don't think there was a lot of corruption at the, even at the ministerial level or any, just below the ministerial level.
So it was reported. It was, I haven't
come
across. I have no personal knowledge.
I mean, have you any criticisms to make of the minister's policy in those periods? I mean, from your personal knowledge, what were the shortcomings?
No, I don't have any criticisms to make. They all were the best, I think, at the time. I think they did a good job starting a, you know, new government in that way, running their own affairs. And they kept on their civil servants.
Mm-hmm.
They gradually, you know, petered out. I've always said it was a model handover, and then everybody was happy. I stayed on for nearly 8 years after independence, and worked recognizing that one was a public servant, one was serving the ministers, and one was, if one was really trying to serve Ceylon and serve one's ministry in that way, one was appreciated and one was happy in one's work.
If I may sort of jump back, I hadn't really asked you anything about the malaria epidemic.
Yes, well, that in 1935-6, was it?
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Well, that was a very awkward, very unpleasant time. I came from Leeds and was appointed A.J. Kunanagala, and the government agent, Harrison Jones, sent me a note saying I can't get government to realize how serious the situation is. By that time I had a second baby. He said, don't bring your baby down here. Well, we did actually, but he said it's very serious. And it was. We lost 5% of the population, you know, by death.
Were statistics at this time of deaths accurate?
Oh yes, I think so, yeah. Yes, it was.
No, usually it's underestimation. I was wondering whether it was.
No, it was really a very appalling time. It was only malaria, but it was caused through drought. The drought, crop after crop failed, the people had the food, they were weak, and so they gave way to the malaria. It was just a vicious circle.
Mm.
And we had to distribute foodstuffs, open temporary hospitals, and it was a very appalling time.
What were the steps, specific steps you took to fight them?
Well, we opened these temporary hospitals and distributed quinine and foodstuffs. People were not given their tea and sugar and rice, and unless they took the quinine, we had to persuade them to.
They were reluctant, were they?
Well, you see, once the fever was over, they didn't realize that
they could probably
had it in their blood, and they just had to take this stuff. There was a tendency to get the medical comforts, as we call them, without taking their medicine.
Doses.
They supposed to go around the corner and pour it down the drain. But, well, atropine was introduced at that time. An experiment was carried out, atropine mucinate, as we call it. It was an atropine which is an aniline dye. You know, atropine by injection. It was a new thing, and a German doctor came over taking this opportunity to try out this new drug. And my wife, Hannah Compton, they both laid low. Eventually I was the only survivor, you know, in that whole district. Government agent had it, and my wife was, it was very severe. And they had this injection, as we must know. And the point was that two injections, the course was finished. Instead of having 3 months of quinine by the mouth, which a villager wouldn't take. So a village, an isolated village, was taken as an experiment. They were now, I forget the name of it. We'll take the whole of this village and inject them and then see what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did. I went out to help them. And they were in the middle of their work when one girl was had the injection.
Mm-hmm.
And she promptly died. She had a sort of very violent reaction to this. So the villagers stopped taking this stuff. It was most unfortunate because they'd all been encouraged to come. They were given.
Was she allergic to this?
But it was very effective, this drug, as in two injections, and this village was very much better than the other. And it was a complete course in two injections. But it was found that it was a very valuable drug, but not in every case, and that it had certain toxic qualities.
Effects,
and in this particular case, it had that effect. But it was most unfortunate it happened that way. But those villagers who had the injection were greatly benefited by it.
I know that government reacted energetically to this epidemic, but do you think they reacted quickly enough? And for instance, Harrison Jones later.
Yes, well, as soon as it was realized. I mean, it's normally a malarial area. I mean, that dry zone. You get worst along the river. When the river got low, the pool formed, the mosquitoes bred, and it was very bad. And it always was. So that it's easy enough to look back, but at the time, you see, you can't realize how bad it is. He realized it, and we did our best. But of course, there weren't all the facilities that there were later for. Spraying the houses and all the more modern drugs. I mean, the DDT spraying was very effective in the houses, but the mosquitoes couldn't find any refuge there.
Would you say something about Mr. Newnham's work as relief commissioner?
He was very effective. Mm-hmm. Yes. He got round, he had his stenographer, he, you know,
tremendous
in
work.
Those days, one didn't do that sort of thing. It's common nowadays, but in those days it wasn't so easily done. And he visited everywhere and took action, and he was most effective in his work.
He had right powers, didn't he?
Yes. He was given ample funds. He was given ample funds and given freedom to do what was necessary. And he did a very good job. He's a man of great ability. I hope you'll see him.
Yes.
Are you going to?
Yes.
Yes.
Just one last question. I was wondering, I've been out in the provinces and ruling strange people. It must have given you great personal satisfaction. You felt to work.
Yes. Well, I try to be a practicing Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And it is my aim in life to help people,
mm-hmm.
do what I can for them. And that is why it was more difficult to be a public servant, because mm-hmm. it's my nature and whole upbringing to serve people. So wherever I was, I tried to serve people, whether it was on the bench or in the, or whatever.
And you preferred this sort of life which brought you into personal touch with what you are doing, mm-hmm. rather than something with a rather impersonal machine?
Yes. It was the circuit, very much so in the villages, that's where one was really happy, knowing people and serving them.
So even in the 1930s, was it still very personal, or was it getting more and more impersonal?
Well, it became more impersonal, of course. Codrington,
yes,
a great man, you know, and he was out, he was in the Mother Table district. Well, he used to disappear for 3 weeks on circuit.
Mm.
He'd got gone, and out of touch with everything. Well, a man like that knows people more than somebody who gets in his car and is back, you know, the same evening. And it was the same everywhere, with the speed of travel and roads being opened up. One didn't get to know the people
as much as the older
people did. They were really more in touch with the people. And there wasn't any interference, you know, from the politicians.
So in a sense, there was some advantage in the lack of civilization, of the, I mean, vehicles and so forth.
Well, from one personal point of view, one did get to know that
people
couldn't cover as much ground, of course.
Comments on interview made on the 28th November 1965. Mr. Bond was hardly conscious of the tape. He gave his views in an utterly unrestrained manner. This was not so much because of a forthright nature, but simply because he was so conscientious. In fact, my stay with Mr. Bond and the interview itself will reveal much of Mr. Bond's nature. For one thing, he was utterly conscientious. Not a quick thinker, and certainly during the interview, not very quick on the uptake. Rather pedantic, deliberate, and slow. A hard worker, and methodical. Humble man, no deep perception, and one I'm sure would have been rather stereotyped in his policies. but a useful man to have under you to work things. Many of his answers show that he would have been a man who worked according to precedence and to routine, followed orders to the bone, and did not deviate. On the whole, one who would not initiate new things. This is a picture of Mr. Bond as he would have been in the 1930s and 1940s too. He would have been a man who made efficiency and integrity his two ideas. And on these two points, he was quite set. One could almost say that he would make a fetish of efficiency. Now this sort of outlook has some bearing on his answers. For instance, his assessments of men would be governed by this outlook. He viewed Stanley and Caldecott, I think, as very able men, whereas a more radical type like Sir Franklin Gibson, for instance, seemed to think them more, well, rather mediocre, somewhat able, but not particularly distinguished. On the other hand, Mr. Bond did discriminate. Not everyone was brilliant or able. He draws a distinction between Stubbs and Thompson, another between Drayton and Collins. Mr. Bond is by no means a fool, but he did seem to, he would have worked, and in his thinking today, thought on rather set lines. He was not and is not at all politically minded. Questions on the LSSP and on the Donoghue Constitution showed that he hardly considered many of the political implications. He was, of course, very much a provincial officer, but even his transfer to Colombo had not evoked a great interest in political questions. At times, an outside listener might think that he is presenting himself under false pretensions. Take, for instance, his reference to his practical Christianity. This, I repeat, is and was not hypocrisy. As I happen to stay the night before with Mr. Bond and his family, I can assure the listeners that they were convinced Christians. And I should add that his wife is a daughter of a missionary who was out in Ceylon. She was, in fact, born in Gaul. Thus, it is not a case of pretension when he says that his attitude to life was considered in terms of service. I should add, however, that he was, as he himself realized, probably quite untypical of most of the civil servants in this respect. Not that other civil servants who were agnostics or nominal Christians did not bring a similar concern.